All right, happy Monday, everybody. Hope you survived the weekend intact. As I promised on Friday, got a guest lined up for today. I was supposed to have him, I don't know, about a week ago, week and a half, I guess. And I didn't realize it was a confusion over the time, the AM, PM thing. He actually showed up 8 p.m. that evening. I didn't stress enough the AM factor. So here he is returning. We're going to get it right this time. I see him waiting in the queue here. Victor Thorne, he's here to talk about his new book, The Holocaust Hoax Exposed. So without any further ado, let's bring him on. Welcome to the show, Victor.
How you doing, Charles? It's great to be here.
Excellent. Great to have you on. I did, in fact, get your book a couple weeks ago. Been looking through it. Looks really good. What I like about it is it's not a huge, thick volume, which very often visually discourages people from wanting to pick up books like that. You know, they don't want to commit themselves to a long, dragged out. You know, actually, that discourages me sometimes. I actually did read, for example, Tragedy and Hope, because there's a lot of very interesting things in there, but that was quite a tedious, laborious undertaking to read a book, you know, of that size. So it's good to see something like this, that it's got everything in there. I mean, all of the most powerful arguments ever assembled all together in one volume, and yet it's very readable. It's something you can probably pop off in one sitting.
Yeah, that's one of the main things I tried to do when I first wrote this book. Was it's only 180 pages. There's, I think, over 100 photographs in it, and it's a quick read. It can be read in one sitting, if not two. And unlike a lot of other books in this area that are very academic, or they focus on minutia, only one aspect of the Holocaust hoax, this here runs the entire gamut. It covers it from front to back, every element of it. And in, you know, a few hours reading, someone can completely reevaluate this greatest hoax of the 20th century, which the Holocaust is. So that was a real important aspect of it when I started compiling this together, was to make it accessible. And secondly, it's written in a way that it's layman's terms, because I am a layman, you know, and it's out there where people don't need to have all kind of expertise in science or anything like that. Anyone can pick this up, read it, and say, my God, we've been completely bamboozled with this Holocaust. So, you know, that's really where I was focusing on, to put it in as many hands as possible and let everyone realize that not only is it a lie, but look at how much damage has been caused since then with the creation of this nation called Israel in the Middle East, and how much trouble they've started since then.
Everything really hinges, really depends upon people believing this fraud. This is how they've mustered up, unwarranted sympathies as though they're victims, when really they're the victimizers. It's key to understand this, to really put this all in perspective. So we'll be diving into this some more, folks, when we get back. Stick with us. All right, everybody, welcome back. Once again, my guest is Victor Thorne. We were just talking before the break about how the Holocaust really is pivotal for the for Israel, for the elite Jew community in general. That this is how they've played on people's emotions, sympathies. Yeah, you know, some people say, "Oh, come on, now, how could they do all that?" They can do all that because they run everything. They control your media. They create your perceptions of reality. And so when they want to make themselves look like victims, they can do that. And they have done that. And people have fallen for it. It's high time we wake up and realize they are not, nor have they ever been, victims. The only time there's ever been any real uprising against them was when people finally got sick and tired of the shenanigans that they've pulled and sought revenge against them. That doesn't make them victims. That makes them recipients of justice. They are the victimizers, folks. That is so vitally important that we understand this. And this is why the Holocaust is not only a fraud, it's a disgusting and despicable one at that. because it makes them out to be the very opposite of what they are. They're not victims. They're victimizers. You know, Victor, whenever people ask me, don't you believe that there was a Holocaust in World War II? I'm all too quick to answer that in the affirmative. Oh, yes, absolutely. It would be foolish of me to deny such a thing. It's well documented. I think it's horrible what the Jews did to the Germans in World War II.
Oh, absolutely. And when we look at this, when we look at this subject, and that's again what I was trying to do with this book, is if we get rid of the emotional impact that's been thrust upon us for the last 60 plus years, and use a little bit of logic and reason and common sense and a little bit of mathematics, you realize that it's an impossibility.
Right.
That their story stands up. And it's interesting because the other day I was reading an article on the Jonestown Massacre. It was in this compilation, Rolling Stone, all the different articles from the 70s. And
yeah.
It said that there were 900-plus bodies there after the, some people call it a suicide, I call it the mass murder. But anyway,
right.
Interestingly, it said that it took 8 days to remove the 900 bodies. Now, just try to imagine this is World War II, the biggest war in the history of mankind. Europe is decimated. The supply lines are taken out, the rail lines, the road, everything. How long would it have taken if it took 8 days to get rid of 900 bodies? Just think of 6 million bodies, supposedly, that were killed. Or if someone says, well, no, no, there weren't bodies, they were all cremated. Okay, well, let's just imagine again for a second. Say there's 6 million bodies that were cremated, and the average body, a cremated body weighs anywhere from 3 to 9 pounds. So let's just say 5 pounds as an average. 6 million times 5 pounds, that's 30 million pounds of ashes. 30 million pounds of ashes. Now, where did all these ashes go? And we know that when someone's cremated, it's not down to a fine powdery dust. There's still chunks of bone and so forth. So if the Nazis were supposedly throwing them in these ovens as fast as they can, there's going to be large pieces of bone and teeth and everything else. 30 million pounds of it. There should be these skeletal remains all across Europe. But we're not seeming to find them, Charles. So that's what I really did in this body or this book was say, let's put away the emotional manipulation that we've been subjected to and instead use some logic and common sense. And when you take that approach, you start scratching your head and saying, my goodness, this doesn't add up.
No, not at all. But then, you know, we're just not to question these things because when the experts tell us, they know much better than we do. And, you know, this is the kind of rhetoric essentially that you'll get. You know, who are you to question why all the great historians of the world, great historians on whose payroll?
Oh, exactly, yeah. And, you know, and here's the other thing is it's people use mantras with us. It's a form of psychic driving or brainwashing or conditioning. But they repeat the same thing over and over again. You'll see it on TV or you'll see it in movies, but they'll say, well, I just talked to somebody, an elderly person that was in one of the camps, and they said that they knew somebody that died, and they even showed me their tattoo. So there, that proves, doesn't it, that there was a Holocaust? And I say to them, I agree with everything you just said. Everything you just said. There were people in camps. They weren't concentration
right.
camps or death camps. They were work camps. They were labor camps. And then they say, well, I knew somebody that died. Yeah, there were a lot of people that died in Europe, especially the last 3 or 4 months of World War II when all the supply lines were cut and all the people in the work camps died from starvation or dehydration or disease. And finally they say, well, what about the tattoo? Well, yeah, the Germans did tattoo their laborers, not only the Jews, but other people too. Why did they tattoo them? Because they were their workers. They were free slave labor. They needed a way to keep track of them. So they didn't have these fancy laminated driver's licenses like we have today, Charles. So the next best thing was put a few numbers on their arm to keep track of them. If you're going to kill somebody, if the Germans were such a ruthless, efficient killing machine, why would they take the time to tattoo them first? I'm going to tattoo you, then I'm going to throw you in the gas chamber. It doesn't make sense.
Well, and from this standpoint, too, I don't know why it never dawned on me years ago when I used to fall for this malarkey, but when you're in the midst of a war, and you're fighting on all fronts, you have to dedicate, you know, all your manpower, all of your resources, all of your finances to that effort to undertake something of this magnitude involving allegedly millions of people. That is going to cost so much money, so much manpower, so many resources while you're trying to fight this war on several different fronts. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you're absolutely right. And right in the beginning of the book, I lay this out again, Charles, a little bit of common sense and logic. There, the Germans during World War II near the end had about 8 million men out in the various fronts fighting for them. And at this point, they were taking anyone from the ages of 16 to 45. Literally any able-bodied German man that could fight was out in the field fighting the Allies. Now, if we look at it in this context, they're out there fighting, but the Germans still need bullets and uniforms and boots and tanks and fighter jets and food and all of these other things. This is a vast, vast war machine. So you have to ask, who was there providing the boots and bullets and tanks and so forth? They needed people to make them. So what the Germans did was they had slave labor. These were people that they had captured, and they put to work at Auschwitz in these industrial centers to make the bullets and boots and tanks. Why would they kill somebody that's free labor that can be used for their cause? It's absurd to think they would do so.
And that's the ultimate way to get even when you're disgusted. You know, Hitler was disgusted with Jewish exploitation of the German people. What better way to get back at them? We'll put them to work for us for a change instead of us slave laboring for them. Why waste that, quote, human resource, right? I just, from a logical standpoint, their picture that they present does not make any sense from any angle you look at it. Okay, folks, short break. Be right back. Okay, everybody, welcome back. So we were just talking before the break. The Holocaust fairy tale, and that's exactly what it is, fails the truth test simply on a common sense basis. Before you even look into the documentation, the actual alleged events, and how they don't match up with reality, Just viewing it from a common sense perspective, you know, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. It's not logical. It's not sensible. It's not something that you're going to want to undertake when you're in the midst of a war. Again, way too much resources, human resources, financial resources, all the supplies, equipment. It's too much of an undertaking, too taxing of an undertaking. To take upon yourself when you're fighting a war on several different fronts. So, you know, that's a good way to start an argument against the Holocaust, is just present it, you know, right there. You've got the person disarmed right off the bat. And then you can start getting into some of the more technical stuff, which, of course, you do in your book. It's a very broad coverage, very well done. Like I said, folks, this is something that, you know, you can hand to... you know, to friends and show them that, hey, look, you know, why don't you just give this a quick read? It's not long. After reading that, if you can walk away and say you still believe in the Holocaust, you weren't even worth the time to waste on in the first place. You just have no semblance of common sense. By the way, did you ever go to the Arch Heretics Holocaust Conference a few years ago there, Ahmadinejad?
Oh, no, I didn't, but Mike Piper from American Free Press that I write for, he was there, and he reported back on it, and there's photos of Piper with Ahmadinejad. And so, yeah, he came back with a full report, and, you know, it's, you know, one of the reasons probably why we have Iran right now in the bullseye is not only is Ahmadinejad, has he spoken about that, but he's also made references about 9/11, which, you know, there's a huge Israeli component to that also. You know, when we look at terrorism, it's, you know, that little nation in the Middle East is the one that has the finger pointed at it first and foremost. If you look at 9/11, USS Liberty, and even OKC bombing, their involvement in it. So they have a long history of this.
Yeah, I was talking about that just a couple of weeks ago, how if you ask me, probably more than anything else, even more than any military threat that they allege Iran poses to poor Israel. I think it's the Holocaust heresy there. That'll do it for you right there. How dare he speak out? And that's brought a lot of attention to this fraud. You know, it's put it in the spotlight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And if anyone is interested in this, they can go to wingtv.net, and that's where the book's available now. But, you know, if we go back to, again, to the logic of it, even if you look at mainstream history books, one of the primary reasons why Germany lost the war is that they ran out of fuel. The fuel, the gasoline was cut off to Germany, so they had to actually manufacture their own fuel, this synthetic fuel. So if they're needing all this fuel, if they already are lacking fuel to start with, and they need it for their planes and their jeeps and their tanks and so forth, and to transport supplies out to the front, why would the Germans use all of this, divert all of these resources to killing Jews in ovens when they already don't even have enough to run their war machine as it is? Now they're going to take even more away from the troops and those out fighting the war, and they're going to use it to burn Jews. And also, we had aerial reconnaissance photos taken all through World War II. We had our planes flying over Germany, taking pictures. If there were these supposed 6 million people killed, which would have required an enormous amount of fuel, where are the photos of the long lines, truck after truck after truck after truck, waiting to get to these quote-unquote concentration camps to get this fuel needed to cremate everybody, to kill them in the ovens? There are no photos. If there were, they would be presented to us. Or if they used coal, where are the huge mountains of coal that would be needed to fire the ovens? There's no photos of them anywhere either. Also, Charles, we're told that the Germans were such efficient killers. They were the most efficient killing machine in the history of mankind. Okay, if we believe that for a second, why don't the Germans, instead of going through this whole rigmarole of ovens and camps, why not just push one bullet to the head? Push one bullet to the head. Why would they waste all of this time? And then we're told, even firing squads, you know, and we're even told by the Jewish Holocaust, quote-unquote, historians, that there wasn't one death camp in Germany per se. Okay, they admit that now today. So in other words, everybody had to be taken out of Germany to other labor camps, as I call it.
Yet originally that was a major part of their story. They backtracked on it.
Right, exactly. So now these efficient killers, the Germans, aren't even killing the Jews on their own soil. What they're doing is loading them up into trains, and they're transporting them to other countries. How efficient is this? Why would the Germans now waste all of that fuel taking Jews up to Hungary or Poland or somewhere else, Czechoslovakia? Why would they be doing that? Why not just have firing squads in Germany and save all of that time and fuel and manpower needed to herd them in, herd them out? I'm sure if somebody is being loaded into a train knowing that imminently they're going to be killed, there's going to be a big struggle on their hands, wouldn't you think? None of these things are ever taken into consideration when we examine the subject.
Nope. Totally ignored. But oy vey, you waste too much time thinking of these things. Just...
Yeah, and you know, if we move forward then to the numbers, this is always another great article.
Oh yeah, yeah.
There's many publications that I list in this book. There's Collier's Magazine, the Daily Express, the World Almanac, the New York Times, a publication called Information Please, and then other various authors that have provided population statistics for all races and people around the world every year. Now, we know, beginning in 1939 or so, when the war started, up into the early 1940s, every year the population of Jews worldwide is listed at approximately 15 million. Goes up a little, down 11, but right into 15 millions. Then we look 1946, 1947, 1948, and guess what the population is of Jews in the world? It's still at 15 million. Now, if we lost 6 million Jews, which would be 40% of their entire population, making it down to about 9 million, why is every one of these studies in various publications saying they're still at 15 million? They haven't lost any. And even by 1947, only 2 years after the war, the number of Jews worldwide is actually higher.
Well, you know, maybe you don't stop to think about things like this. So maybe they're like paramecium. You know, you cut them in half and now you got two. You ever stop to think of that?
I mean, it could be, Charles. Anything's possible, I guess.
Oh, my God. And, of course, I'm sure you know about the 6 billion number in the Talmud that talks about, you know, the Romans having killed 6 billion. There weren't even 6 billion people in the entire world.
No.
In the whole history of the Roman Empire, and yet 6 billion Jews were killed, though.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
They tried this in World War One, the same number, 6 million. It didn't work. Ay. The lies, folks, there's no end to them. It's incredible. All right, another short break. Be right back. Okay, everybody, welcome back. We've only got Victor Thorne with us for the first hour, so I want to give him a chance to get as much information out there as possible. Before we continue, Victor, and I want you to get into, you know, some of the... like swimming pool in Auschwitz, you know, some of the entertainment factors. They even had a hospital there. How could this be a concentration camp, a death camp, when they got a hospital on the premises? But before we get into that, I wanted you to mention, you mentioned Wing TV for people to get your book. Are there any other websites or anything else that you wanted to plug?
Yeah, they can go to wingtv.net, which is my website where the book is available, or also they can go to the Barnes Review, which is publishing the same book. They just put a different cover on it. So barnesreview.com, I believe it is, or wingtv.net, and either one of those places they can find it.
All right. And once again, folks, it's called The Holocaust Hoax Exposed. Excellent read, very short, easy to you know, pour through in a short time. So, yeah, let's talk about that. Some of these facilities on the premises there at Auschwitz, and, of course, the other camps as well. But Auschwitz is the most well-documented, the one that people are most familiar with. Anybody can go there today and tour the thing and see for themselves. Now, of course, they don't include, you know, like the swimming pool per se in the tour, but it is there, and if you ask about it, they'll show it to you. What the heck is that doing at a death camp?
Right. Well, you got to remember that Auschwitz especially was a huge and enormous sprawling industrial center. And these were places German companies like IG Farben and Krupp were there. This was the primary place where the German war machine was going. So at Auschwitz, there were actually 39 different work facilities there within Auschwitz. And 19 alone were deployed by the Jews, okay? So you had 19 different centers that the Jews were working at. And what we had there was swimming pools. You had a symphony hall there. You had soccer fields. You had a hospital. Jewish women were actually giving birth to children there. If you simply want to efficiently kill people, why do you want to make them better first? Why do you want to take them to the hospital? So, well, we want to make sure that they don't have the flu, that they don't have, you know, before we kill them. We want to make sure they're... No, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
And another thing is, if we go back to this country's history and slavery, if you're on a plantation and you need the fields plowed and the crops picked and so forth, do you want your workers to be strong or do you want them to be weak? Well, obviously you want them to be strong. So that's why they had the hospital there. That's why they were fed so well there. That's why after the workday was over, they actually allowed them to play soccer. They allowed them to go to the symphony at night, because a happy worker, at least relatively, is much more productive than one who isn't, than one who is sick or weak or disgruntled. So if we look at it in that context, why would they have a hospital and these other things? Why would they want the Jews to actually feel better? We want them to feel better before we kill them? It doesn't make sense.
No.
So,
there's German government documents now that have been released which show that Hitler wanted them to receive physical examinations on a regular basis to make sure they were in tip-top shape.
Right. That's one of the a couple documents I provide in the book, references to these documents, actually have Hitler saying that there were too many people dying from sickness or whatever in the work camps during World War II, and that's understandable that, you know, this was a raging war going on. So he sent memos out to the various camps and said, "I want the death rate to be minimized at these places." And then there's return memos saying that, you know, "We've increased this by X amount percent." So, you know, everyone was cognizant of that if you have workers, you want them to be productive. Now, one of the chapters in the book, I address a man named Fred Leuchter, who went over to Germany and studied not only the German camps, but also at Auschwitz. And he wanted to find how prevalent Zyklon B was. Now, everybody knows, I'm sure, that Zyklon B was supposed to be the gas that killed millions and millions of Jews within these camps. Well, he went over there, and he found that in the quarters, in these death chambers, supposedly, that were used, there was virtually no traces whatsoever of Zyklon B found in these death chambers. He went to over and over and over different ones, could find none of them. But guess where he did find significant traces of Zyklon B? In the delousing chambers. Right. Ah, wait a second now. Now we're getting somewhere. Delousing chambers.
Which are small, and you can't even fit one person in there.
Right. And what the delousing chambers were is that's where they're putting the clothes and the boots and everything and getting the lice out of them. One of the biggest killers, if not the biggest killer, during World War II was typhus. It came from lice. So now when we see these pictures, these propaganda pictures, where the Jews have their heads shaved, and you have these huge stacks of clothes and boots. Yeah. Everyone says, "See, look, that proves there was a Holocaust." No, they were shaving their heads because there were dirty conditions during World War II. Yeah. They were getting the lice out of the hair. It's like if your pet has ticks or something, you shave their hair to get rid of the ticks. It's the same thing over there. They put the clothes in the delousing chambers. They shaved their heads. And what it was, Charles, it ends up that these work camps, these labor facilities that the Jews were in and others, ended up being the safest places in Europe during World War II. Certainly, the German people had conditions far worse than people did in the work camps. And one of the reasons why was that with Zyklon B, it saved lives. It didn't take lives. Right. And the United States used the same thing. They just didn't use that product per se. They had a similar product with a different name. Lice was a big problem because of the unsanitary conditions during war. So, you know, again, we've been horribly lied to about Zyklon B.
It's the perfect scam because, yeah, you go there on the tour and you see those canisters in the display case, and automatically it's to conjure up ideas, and they help to facilitate that kind of thinking on the tour, that when you see those canisters, you're supposed to envision the horror of, you know, the chambers, but that's not what they were used for. In fact, that was the use for Zyklon B at the time, was delousing.
Yeah, delousing, and even, you know, Leuchter and other scientists even said that to kill people, even if Zyklon B was used to kill people, it's one of the least efficient ways that there is because it takes so long for the pellets and the gas to get out there and circulate through a room that, I mean, again, we're told Germans were such efficient killers. Why would they use something that's so inefficient to do so? And then, once you get even deeper into the book, you start seeing how preposterous the stories are because not only was Zyklon B supposedly used, but listen to all these other death modes. These modes of death that were supposedly used against the Jews. They said they were killed in steam chambers, with electric currents, with pneumatic hammers to the head. Some even said that the Germans used an atomic bomb to kill some of them. Mm-hmm. Then they're also told that there were gas vans and bone grinding machines and quicklime and even blood poisoning stations. So, I mean, they used basically every medieval technique known to mankind, supposedly, you know, not only Zyklon B. And when you start thinking about this, even, you know, like the diesel vans, that this is, again, another extremely inefficient way to kill people. And it's, you know, when you go into their fake memoirs then, and that's another argument people will use. They'll say, well, what about all these books that have been written by the survivors? And I says, well, what about all these books? So I have an entire chapter about the memoirs that these people have written, almost all of them, which have been proven to be fakes now over the years, that they completely just made this stuff up.
And the Anne Frank diaries.
The Anne Frank diaries is the Anne Frank diaries is actually tame lie-wise compared to some of these other ones. I mean, these are so outlandish that if you would see this in a Hollywood movie, you would walk out of the theater saying, there's no way this could possibly happen, you know?
Right.
And there's so many of them that keep coming out. And, you know, there's that man a few years ago that went on Oprah's show.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the love story between him and his wife. And it ends up, he lied about the whole thing.
Yeah, they're all hoaxes. Anyway, short break, folks. Stick with us. Grab back. All right, everybody, welcome back. Already into our final segment here. I can't believe how fast the time goes by. In the remaining few moments, Victor, I want to give you the floor here. Just, you know, hit some more highlight points, the really hard-hitting stuff that you think is going to really, you know, most of my listeners are already on board with this, but some really highlight points, real highlight points from your book that really drive the point home that this thing is unbelievably fraudulent. There's just no truth to any of it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I alluded to before the last break was these memoirs. And people put a lot of faith in these, that, you know, here's a Holocaust survivor, and they have the little tattoo on their arm, and they take the effort to write this book, and it's published, it's out there, and they do the talk show circuit and tell their stories. Well, I go back and I find these memoirs and analyze them, and other people before me have analyzed them. There's a woman named Misha DeFonseca, who was supposedly a Holocaust survivor, okay? And she says as a little girl, she escaped from one of the camps, and she went on this 1,900-mile quest across Germany. She was escaping. And as a 10-year-old girl, during her escape, she even killed an SS officer that was trying to capture her, to get her back to the camp. Now, the most efficient killing machine in history, the Germans supposedly, and here's a little 10-year-old girl that kills, according to her, one of the SS officers that tried to kill her. So she's still on her escape. And she ends up having a love affair with some older man so that she can survive, okay? Anything necessary to survive. Then she's out in the woods. She has nowhere to go. So what does Misha do now in her own book, according to her? What does she do? She ends up living with a pack of wolves, okay? The wolves take care of her. And then, because she has no food, she's only a 10-year-old girl, guess who feeds her? The wolves go out, and they kill other animals, and they bring the food back, and the wolves are feeding Misha, okay? And if she doesn't have any of the food from the wolves, then she eats mud and grass, according to her, to survive. So this is one of the memoirs that people allude to and say, well, look, there's proof.
Does she have a cape and flies, too?
Well, there's now another woman. Her name's Irene Zisblatt.
Oh,
she
yeah.
Wrote, you know her, okay.
Oh, yeah.
And she wrote a book called The Fifth Diamond, okay. And she says that her mother was going to get killed by the Germans in one of these death camps. So what the mother did was she sewed four diamonds into Irene's dress so that she could have them. You know, if she ever needed something, if she escaped, she had the four diamonds to buy food with. So she goes into Auschwitz, and she has the diamonds, but she doesn't want the Germans to find out about them. So what Irene does, according to her, is every morning she takes the diamonds out of her dress and swallows the diamonds. Then that night, she defecates the diamonds back out again and saves them, puts them in her dress, and then the next day she swallows them again. And this, so for 14 months, Charles,
yeah,
every day, this was the process, four diamonds. Now, she doesn't go into, you know, diamonds I think are sharp. Don't they cut glass and things like that?
Right.
But these diamonds, they don't slice Irene's tongue or her throat or her
esophagus. Well, she's a superwoman, too.
She is, you know, doesn't slice her intestines, her stomach. And, you know, we're told, if we believe the propaganda, that there was no water there for the Jews. You know, many of them died of dehydration. So if Irene is doing this with the diamonds, how is she washing the diamonds every day so that once they come out one end, she's swallowing them in her mouth the next day? You know, how is she washing? If there's no water, if they're all dying from that. And then, so anyway, then,
I think we got a great laxative commercial in the making here.
No kidding. It's fantastic. And so then she says that she escapes from inside one of the gas chambers. She's already in the gas chamber, ready to be executed. But Irene, who can swallow diamonds on a daily basis, escapes from inside the gas chamber. Then she climbs over an electric fence, a fence that's electrically charged, escapes. She also said that she was a guinea pig for Joseph Mengele's experiments.
Yeah.
And then finally, after she escapes and she, you know, she gets away from everybody, then George S. Patton comes and visits her in the hospital. Ah, what a great story, huh?
Unbelievable. Yeah, this was one of the highlights of Spielberg's Last Days film there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Another one they interviewed, he was supposedly the guy who liberated her and her whole camp, that the black guy was from Boston. I forget his name now. He turned out to be a complete fraud. He had nothing to do with any liberation front. He was stationed hundreds of miles away. He was a minesweeper. I mean, the whole story just completely crumbles to dust. There's no truth to any of it.
Yeah. And then we have Elie Wiesel,
still out
on the lecture circuit. And I was telling somebody about this book last weekend, it was actually. And they said, well, what about Elie Wiesel and his book Night? And I says, I'm really glad you brought up that book. Because in this book, Elie Wiesel says, now he's a guy that supposedly escaped from something like 13 different concentration camps. Okay?
Yeah, never produces a tattoo either.
Yeah, these efficient killers, but he escapes from 13 camps. Well, Elie Wiesel says that there were so many Jews killed during World War II by the Germans that there was actually blood bubbling up out of the ground from the dead Jews. Now, just imagine that. Imagine how ridiculous that is. And he also said then that the Germans were throwing live Jews into open pits of fire. Now, even the Jewish Holocaust historians try to sway or, you know, stay away from that story because they know what a lie it is.
Ridiculous, yeah.
Yeah. But guess who, Charles? Guess who actually did throw their children into pits of fire back in biblical time? It was the Jewish people. The god was called Moloch. And they would sacrifice their children. The Jewish parents would throw their children into pits of fire to Moloch. So what they did was basically say, well, we're the ones that actually did this, so let's blame it on the Germans.
Make it look like
it's just another lie.
Oh, they ate their own kids' flesh, too, during the Roman revolt of 70 A.D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all of these things, that these crimes that they commit, essentially they use transference and projection and just project it out against their enemies. And, you know, one last thing before the show ends, we have to remember, who was the first people to actually declare war back in 1933? Was it the Germans that declared war on the Jews? No, it wasn't.
The other way around.
It was the famous headline, Judea declares war on Germany, 1933. And they have this economic boycott, and the Jew says, we're going to screw you. We're going to run you into the ground. We're going to starve you out.
Yep.
Now, Hitler and the rest of the German people say, we don't want to be starved out by you. And they already own all the banks and the media and the factories in Germany. And Hitler finally says, we're done with it. You know,
we're done
with you. We want you out of our country. The final solution, Charles, wasn't about execution. The final solution meant we want
Get
you
out.
Away from us.
Get the hell out. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't want to live
like so many people. Other countries have done all through the centuries. Enough is enough.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, final solution here, my friend. Pack your bags.
Yeah. So it's all right here in this book, The Holocaust Hoax Exposed. It's on wingtv.net. And I guarantee anybody out there, you know, it's a short read. Give it to a friend, then have them give it to another friend. This here proves within, you know, a few hours of reading that this is the biggest hoax of the 20th century and one of the biggest ones in history.
Unquestionably. And it's so important to expose this because when that pin falls, everything else falls with it. Everything hinges on that. They depend on people's sympathy. Once you realize they're not worthy of sympathy, that the whole thing's a lie, you know, then you're going to start asking other questions. What else have they lied to about? You lied to us about. They control the media, folks.
Well, without the Holocaust, then they wouldn't have been able to steal this land from the Palestinians in the Middle East and create this outlaw country, which is what Israel is.
Yeah, they've got us in a vice, folks. It's time to set ourselves free from that death grip. Anyway, thanks a lot, Victor. Great stuff. Folks, again, check out his book, Wing TV, wingtv.com, and you can order it there. Okay.
Thanks, Charles.
You bet. We'll keep in touch, and any more developments you got coming out, I want to know about it. We'll get you back on.
Take care.
You too. Okay, folks, be right back. Stick with us.